Hey, everyone, welcome to another edition of the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. And it feels like it's been ages since I put one out. I've got a lot of interviews banked from ones I've done earlier, but this is the first interview since my return from Spain. But this interview actually did before the trip to Rueda. And the interview is with a legend, Philippe Gugel. One of the most famous wine producers in Rhone. They make brilliant Syrahs from Northern Rhone, great Côte de Rhones. They even do some Chateauneuf du Pape and underrated white wine as well. I'll say this, the white wine from like Southern Rhone, or even Northern Rhone. I mean, Northern Rhone, we know a little bit more. There's a wine, in case for people don't know, called Condru, which is in a small appellation by the same name, 100% Syrah. And that one gets a lot of attention. It's, you know, it's not cheap, and it's got a really great reputation because it's damn good. But Southern Rhone white wine, like the Marsan, Roussan grapes, these are really good stuff. They don't get talked about a lot. And there's plenty of power and body and just a honeyed, waxy nose. It's really good stuff. If you've never tried it, go to, you know, your local wine store, LCBO. I doubt there'll be a huge amount of it, but if there's some, give it a try. So Philippe Gugel is part of, obviously, the Gugel Winery. They've been making wine for ages. His grandfather, and he tells a great story, his grandfather actually made or vinified 67 vintages, which is nuts. For Philippe, he's around number 25. So that's the interview you're going to hear in a couple minutes. But I wanted to use the opportunity, because it is Gugel, to talk about something that happens in so many families' life, especially, you know, families where wine is a big part, and there's a lot of it around. I'm going to tell you the story of just, and we've all had this happen to us, when someone opens something they shouldn't have, and they didn't realize. They open a much nicer bottle on a Wednesday night, and they didn't know, you know, that was the wine that was probably should have been held off for a weekend, an anniversary, or something bigger than, I'm going to watch The Bachelor. So a while ago, this was when I was doing morning radio. And morning radio, you wake up at 4, 4:30. You're not usually in a very good mood when you wake up at that time. So I just want to set the scene. The night before, my girlfriend and her twin sister, we were hanging out, having dinner, and had a bottle of wine going. Then I was going up to go to bed. I'm like, okay, girls, I'm going to bed. I grabbed another bottle from the wine fridge and said, here you go. You know, knock yourself out. Have a great rest of the night. I go to bed. Wake up the next morning. I go downstairs. And I was like, oh, how come my girlfriend never in bed? Never came upstairs. So I see her and her twin sister, and they're asleep on the couch. And their heads, it was a very cute tableau. They were both sort of resting on each other, asleep on the couch. So I do a little bit of cleaning. And I see, oh, there's the bottle that I gave them. They finished it. Great. And I'm like, oh, there's another bottle opened. And it's about a little more than half done. And I was like, ah, that's cool. I stayed up late, had a little more wine. You know, that's great. Life is short. Enjoy yourself. And then I took a look at it. And I don't blame my girlfriend for the mistake she made. Because we often drink the Philippe Gugel Côte de Rhone. This was, it used to go for under $20. Now it's about $20.95. And even at that price, it's a steal. And I actually talk about that wine with Philippe Gugel. So I won't go into much detail here about it because I go into a lot in the interview. And this was a bottle we buy all the time. I still buy it. It's a great house wine. It's plenty of character. It's a good wine. And it's not crazy expensive. Unfortunately, she didn't get a Gugel Côte de Rhone. Now, she got a Gugel, but she got a La Moulin, which is one of their more famous wines. They have these three wines, the Lala wines, and it's basically some of their top-level Syrah from Côte Rôti, from the really steep hillside vineyards. This one is in one called Côte Blonde. And it's 89% Syrah, around 89% Syrah, then the rest Viognier. And yes, you can blend white wine into a red wine. And it's a beautiful wine. And I got this wine as a gift from the National Club for hosting an event. And it was, I think it was 2006. And I've been sitting on that wine for, by this point, it had been close to 2 years. And I would see it every now and then. I'm like, hey, buddy, Look at you just sitting there on the wine rack. Yeah, I can't wait to open you. And the wine's like, yeah, we're going to have fun together. I'm like, I know, I can't wait. So there I am, 4:40 in the morning, not in the best mood, holding this bottle of beautiful Syrah in my hands, knowing that, and I got no problem sharing this. Of course I would have, but they wouldn't have, they didn't understand the context of the wine. How could they have? It was their final couple glasses of the night. Your final couple glasses, all you really want is something that's varietally correct. Does it taste like what the grape, what it's made from? That's it. That's all you want. You don't need anything fancy. Just, do I enjoy the taste? Does it taste good? And I think this happens, you know, this happens every now and then. And, you know, my girlfriend's great. I feel bad. Like, she always, you know, says, oh, what can I open? And she's smart enough. She knows. I mean, we've lived together for ages. Never screwed up. Always knows what to grab. And I remember doing that when I was younger, when I was, you know, still living at home, my final days living at home. I would always, if I was going to grab a bottle, you know, my rule was find something that my stepdad already had lots of. If there's one bottle, stay away from it. You know, also try to make sure it's a more recent vintage. If it's an older bottle of wine, don't grab it. So even before I started to study wine, those were sort of my rules. And, you know, Amy knows, and I'm always happy. I love sharing wine. When I'm not home, I might go grab something. And you know, Amy's smart enough, been around long enough. She knows what to get, what to avoid. This, though, was the one time. And I bet everyone listening, I bet so many of you have these stories. I've heard it from other friends where someone opened an Opus 1 for a, because, you know, their partner felt like a glass of wine at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. So the partner opened it up, didn't realize it was an Opus 1. And they're probably thinking to themselves, damn, this is a, what did I open? This tastes really super good. I remember I actually tweeted at, I think it was the Toronto Sun, they had their relationship advice person who tweeted out, hey, do you got a problem with your partner? Let me know. And I actually tweeted back to them, and, you know, they got 50, 70, 100,000 Twitter followers. I never expect a response. I tweeted what happened, and this relationship advice Twitter account with the Toronto Sun wrote back almost immediately and said, I think it's time you end the relationship. Which I thought was quite funny. No. Well, you know, these things happen. Nope. Time to end the relationship. So that is my tale of when the wine selection process went bad. It's become, though, now a funny story. We were actually at the National Club last night, and we're sharing that story with people there. And Amy, my girlfriend, was so nice. She went to the National Club the next day, and after I told her, and I was fine. By the end of the day when I came home, I wasn't angry. It was more just the morning, and I was making fun of her, and she felt so guilty. And to her credit, she went to the club. She asked, do you have any more bottles of this? Brian Perry, the wine director, had to say, no, that was our last one. Eventually, Amy, she grabbed something else, a really nice Chateau Beaucastel. It's a Southern Rhone, but, you know, still a whole lot of Syrah. I wasn't quibbling. It was great. If Amy's not listening to this, it wasn't as good as the Lala, but the thought was there, and just one of those mistakes that soon after it happens, all you do is laugh about it. And that's another piece of advice. Don't get mad. I mean, you can get mad for maybe 30 seconds. After that, move on. Wine is meant to be shared. It's meant to be enjoyed. And these mistakes, they're going to happen. It's pretty much inevitable. Anyway, enough rambling for me. Again, thank you so much, everyone, for listening. I do have a bunch more interviews. I think I might start putting them out on a little bit quicker basis. It's been like a week and a half per episode. I'm going to try to tighten that up a little bit, especially after the Raptors are done in the playoffs. It is mayhem. It is crazy. I love being this version of busy with the Raptors, really close to winning an NBA championship. I have been debating what bottle to open if they do indeed beat the Golden State Warriors. So without further ado, he is the winemaker for Gugel. Here is Philippe Gugel.
The title is clunky, but the wine talk is smooth. You're listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to another edition of the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. And today I am with Philippe Gugel. For people who don't know, this is a celebrity in the wine world. He might not want to admit it, but one of the number one most famous and also most important producers in Northern and Southern Rhone, Philippe Gouguel, winemaker. Thank you so much for being part of the podcast.
Thank you very much. I'm so happy to talk with you today.
Yeah, so am I. We're at the National Club. We're getting set for a lunch that's going to be in a little bit. So I'll try to keep this as fast as possible because I could talk with you for about 2 hours. I want to go in a little bit of a different direction. Could you explain, for your entry-level Côte de Rhône, how long does that wine spend in oak, and how long do you age it before you release it?
Most people see the Côte du Rhône as a humble wine and a humble appellation. I very much agree by the fact that Côte du Rhône is a humble appellation, but I definitely disagree to produce a humble wine.
Yeah.
So we're going to spend a lot of time and put a lot of dedication to produce this classic Côte du Rhône. The answer to your question is 3 years. We have a lot of time to make this wine, to think of this wine, to think of the blends, and to age it. Most of the people, or most of the actors in the Rhône Valley, would consider that things should go fast. And when you look at the vintages that are available on the market on the Côte du Rhône, you would see that most Côte du Rhône on the market are from the 2017 vintage. We're still on the 2015, so we like to take our time. As you said, we have large barrels. We name them foudre, where we would age the Côte du Rhône for about 1 year, 1 year and a half. So we're going to take some time to age this wine the same way we would age a high-quality wine.
And the reason I bring that up, because I want to talk about your journey, is sometimes you can, the way I judge larger wine producers, how I judge them is how much care do they put in their entry level wine? And the fact that a wine that you can buy here in Ontario for around $20, sometimes a little bit less, sometimes $20.95, whatever it is, that's impressive because usually for a wine of that price point, there's not going to be as amount of time and attention put into it. You're going to do that more in your La La wines, your single vineyard stuff. And I always thought that's one thing I was most impressed about Gouguel, was the attention you put in the entry level, because for especially young people getting into wines, or people that don't know better, it's really nice when even the lower price point wines still that you put the passion involved in it. I wanted people to know that that you guys do that.
That's an interesting point, because in our family we've always considered that we would love people to discover the Rhône Valley or to discover Gigal through a bottle of La Mouline, La Turque, or La London, which is among the best wines that we produce. But it's never the case.
No.
Most people would discover the Gigal winery and the Gigal family through, let's say, the Côte du Rhône. That is to say, the most simple wine that we produce. But if the wine is good, I would say it's not enough, simply because there are a lot of good wines around the world today.
Yeah.
If people buy this bottle for around $20, as you said, and people say, wow, we have a lot of pleasure for, let's say, an amount of money that is acceptable, I think we've won something. We've won someone interested in the Rhône. We've won someone who's interested in what we do, in the dedication we place in our wine. So, yes, you've underlined something that is very important to our family.
Speaking of your family, started around 1946, your grandfather, Etienne. And do I have this right? Was it 57 vintages? How many vintages did your grandfather head up?
So my grandfather vinified 67 vintages.
67?
Yes.
That is crazy.
And I work every day with my dad, who is going to celebrate his 58th vintage this year. And I feel like a baby with 25 vintages on my side only.
Only 25. What was it like for you? Because you started at around 18 years old. And I love this quote. You went to the university you went to was an intensive 4-year class at the University of Don't Screw Up My Wines, taught by my father, which was your quote. I'm wondering, what was it like for you at 18 starting to work? Because there must have been pressure going into and trying to represent your family's business.
I would like to say that my father has always been very generous, because what we prefer in our job is not to stand in front of a computer and answer to emails. It's very much to be in the vineyards and to spend time in the winery to make the wines.
Yeah.
And my dad has been very generous. When I was at a very young age, he said, okay, you've studied enology, you know the theory, you have to go through the practice, and I leave it to you. So I've been able, let's say, to take care of the vintage and work in the vineyards, work in the cellars very quickly. It was next door. It was very close to me. If ever I had a question or something, it was not far away. And I'll be honest with you, I had very, very little pressure on my shoulders.
Oh, that's good.
It's been a perfect way to start in this beautiful business.
How, because you're born in 1975, correct?
Correct.
Yeah, so we're born the same year. How different are you as, you said 25 vintages is the amount. How different are you as a winemaker now versus when you started?
When you start, you're very good in theory. So I've been very fortunate to study in France. I'm an enologist from the University of Dijon in Burgundy.
Yep.
I also spent time in UC Davis, not too far away from here. And let's say I had a great vision of worldwide winemaking and techniques that could be applied to, let's say, historical appellations such as Côte-Rôtie. When you live in Côte-Rôtie, when you spend time in Côte-Rôtie, when you work with someone who's vinified 58 vintages, you touch, let's say, practice versus theory.
Right, yeah.
I'm more practical guy today than a theory guy I was in the past.
What do you have any stories of just some of the toughest moments for you, toughest vintages?
You know, the vintage I started with when I was 18 years old. So I was more behind my father's shoulders than really acting, was 1993.
Yep.
And my dad told me it's probably one of the worst vintage I've ever seen in my life.
Huh.
So it was a difficult start, and I've started with the worst, if I may say. On the one hand. On the other hand, vintages like 1999, 2010, 2015, or 2018, which is the last vintage we've made last year, were among the very best that my father ever saw as well.
Yeah, so, I heard him raving about 2015.
Yes, 2015 is literally tremendous in Northern Rhône, and my father has claimed that it was the best vintage he has ever seen.
For people who don't know, because for this podcast, it's for people getting into wine and people that have been into it for their whole life. What for you defines if you a bad vintage versus a good vintage? What would you say are the biggest differences?
Let's say, generally speaking, and if I may place it this way, winemakers are never happy. That is to say, you've always had the rain when you didn't want the rain, or you didn't have the rain when you wanted it. So, you know, perfection does not exist in our world. Sometimes you have vintages like 1993 where, it was very, very difficult. We had really too much rain, and there's a point where the vine says enough, and if it doesn't stop by this time, you're in trouble. So rot is arriving, and we had, you know, maturity issues, rot issues, and you know, it's a fruit at the beginning, so if the fruit doesn't look good, we're not magicians, so we cannot make great wines. A vintage like 2015, honestly, I don't have to complain. We had the perfect amount of rain when we wanted. The rain stopped during the harvests, and we had a beautiful season to mature the grapes. So, yes, it's like a magical vintage for us, where everything went extremely well. It's gambling. It's gambling. Sometimes you have vintages that are starting very, very bad, and ending beautifully well, and it's true the other way around as well. So sometimes we could expect the best, and eventually we have some water of 2 or 3 days before we pick the grapes, and it's less interesting. So what I love about this job is that we work with nature. So whether we like it or not, whether we've planned it or not, nature decides.
I was wondering if you could tell people a little bit about the Lala wines, which I believe began the late 70s, around 1978. It's one of the calling cards for Gugel, and they're some of the most famous, and just, well, they're delicious. I mean, you know, I could wax poetic about them, but these are just some of the most delicious expressions of Cote Roti, of Syrah. I was wondering if you could explain a little bit about what the Lala wines are all about for people who might not know.
First of all, the name, Lala wines. La is the French for the. Mm-hmm. So the name of these three designated vineyards are La Mouline, La Turque, and La London. And they are, let's say, unique expressions of micro terroirs within the Cote Roti appellation. So Cote Roti is a magnificent place where we grow grapes and make wines for the past 2,400 years old. So it's an incredible, scale in the history. And within the Cote Roti territory, you have these three outstanding plots located in different soils with different exposures, with different expressions, even different grapes, because despite the fact that we have a single red grape in Northern Rhône being the Syrah grape or Shiraz, there can be a little touch of Viognier, a typical white grape from Northern Rhône as well, in Cote Roti. And there are different percentages of Viognier within these three terroirs of La Mouline, La Turque, and La London.
What are the differences between the three? And I heard you talking about it, about the big difference in Cote Roti between the more northern part and the most southern reaches of it.
I would say the soil difference is important. So forgive me for being a little bit boring as a winemaker.
No. This is meant to be some broad stuff, but I want to go wine geek with you. Go.
The southern part of Cote Roti is the kingdom of schists. So we find these schists with limestone and silica on the surface. And when the Syrah grows on limestone, Syrah appears extremely delicate. Almost Burgundian. It's extremely elegant with little red fruits, extremely delicate. Whereas on the northern part of the appellation, you still find these schists, but they are compressed, and it brings also a little touch of clay. And you have the presence of iron oxide and manganese that are going to bring, let's say, more power. Mm-hmm. The wines in the northern part of the appellation, the Côte Brune, will show more tannins, more structure, more depth. So Cote Roti is this place where you have the southern part of the appellation, the Côte Blonde, showing extreme elegance, and the northern part showing more tannins, more shoulders. La Mouline is located in the heart of the Côte Blonde. So it's a kingdom of elegance. La London is much northern, with a lot of iron oxide and manganese, and it's like a wild young man with big muscles, if I may say. And La Turque is in the Côte Brune, but very close to the Côte Bronze. So it's almost a mix of delicacy and power.
Yeah, and it is always so fascinating, because when you look on a map, they don't look that far apart, but yet they can give such different expressions. Why is it that the Rhone Valley, why is it took so long to get discovered? If you look at old wine atlases or just, you know, wine books, it's in France. It's Bordeaux and Burgundy get almost all the attention. And then near the end, it's like, oh yeah, here's Côte de Rhone, and here's Cote Roti, and here's Chateauneuf du Pape. Why is it that that area, it took so long to get the focus, to get the spotlight on it?
You're absolutely right. It took a lot of time. I can remember maybe 20 or 15 years ago, big books talking about French wines. Half of the book was for Bordeaux, one third was from Burgundy, pages for Alsace, etc. One or two pages for the Rhone Valley. And believe it or not, the Rhone Valley is the second largest wine region in France after Bordeaux. So my vision is that the phylloxera crisis has been a serious issue for our region. So we're by the end of the 19th century. The French vineyards in general disappear because of this disease. Mm-hmm. And the Northern Rhône, being an extreme region with impressive slopes. We're talking about slopes of 100%. That is to say 45 degrees in the Northern Rhône.
Oh, I want to ask about that in a second.
Yes. Yeah. So it's not helping. Yeah. It's followed by the First World War, then World War II. And by the end of World War II, a vineyard like Côte Rôtie is miserable in many ways. So it's extremely tiny. The reputation had gone. That is to say, these wines were extremely well known by the end of the 19th century or even mid-19th century. You know, the Philippic crisis, the two wars made that in a matter of 50 years, people forgot. And it took a lot of years. And it's probably in the beginning of the 80s where people like Robert Parker in the US, you know, English wine writers, French wine writers started to say, okay, the Rhône Valley is not only simple Côte Rhône. There can be great Côte Rhône, and there are also historical appellations such as Côte Rôtie, Condrieu, Hermitage in the north, Châteauneuf-du-Pape in the southern part. And slowly but surely, the Rhône Valley has started to recover. Today, I would say the Rhône Valley wines appear as trendy wines, mm-hmm. which is interesting because we are probably among the most historical places where wines have been produced around the world since, you know, the beginning of winemaking in human history. And it's a discovery for many people around the world today. We have interesting grapes. We have the Syrah grapes. We have the Grenache in the south. But we have the trendy Viognier grape, the Marsanne, the Roussanne, et cetera, et cetera, yeah. et cetera.
By the way, the rap band, the Beastie Boys, they actually have a song where they actually rhyme Châteauneuf-du-Pape in one of their songs. And so I remember, as you know, when I was listening to them when I was younger, that's one of the few wines I knew before I got into wine, because of the Beastie Boys. You mentioned the Northern and Southern Rhône. I found something interesting. You were talking about how climate change hasn't really affected you guys in the Côte Rôtie, but has had more of an impact in Châteauneuf-du-Pape. I was wondering if you could explain to the listeners just why the difference.
When I talk about the climate change, I need to talk about the two sides of my brain. You have the Northern Rhône side, which says that, okay, climate change is impacting the picking time of our grapes in the north, but eventually it's not that bad. Mm-hmm. That is to say, rather than picking the grapes late of September, beginning of October, that is to say, by a time when it can be very rainy in Northern Rhône, we pick before. And picking before the rain is always better. So my vision is that the global warming in Northern Rhône is impacting, but not in a negative way, in terms of the quality of the wines that we can produce. If I mention the Southern Rhône, I'm going to have a very different speech, because it's worrying. We can try to pick earlier, but you need to get the maturity of the tannins, yeah. the maturity of the phenolics in general. And you cannot pick too early. You cannot look at the sugars only. You have to think of the phenolic maturity of the red wines. I'm not a pessimistic guy. And I would like to say that very fortunately, the Southern Rhône allows different grapes. So Syrah is there, but Grenache is there for ages, and more important grape varieties such as Mourvèdre,
yeah.
That are ripening a little bit later, can be very useful to balance the blends and to make wines that are staying elegant and beautiful. So in the Northern Rhône, with one grape and the Syrah grape, we have more ripeness, but we stay balanced. In the Southern Rhône, we have to think of our blends and think of the secondary or tertiary grapes. Keeping in mind that an appellation like Châteauneuf-du-Pape can use up to 13 different grapes. There are grapes that you've probably never heard about, like the Terre Noire, the Muscardin, the Picardon, yep. the white grapes, etc., etc.
We had to study that back for a diploma. You had to memorize all 13 grapes. Exactly. It can be hard. It can be hard.
Can be hard.
Yeah.
But at the end, I think if they've been allowed in the production of Châteauneuf-du-Pape, it can be useful nowadays with the climate change. And in order to balance the wines, more and more people think of the Clairette rather than the white Grenache or others to make wines that are balanced and enjoyable for people.
Yeah, interesting. I never thought maybe Mourvèdre becomes more important with climate change. You mentioned before, how hard is it for the people that are working in the vineyard? Because I went and visited Gougal and I was in the Côte Rôti, and you mentioned before just about how steep it is. We always focus on Moselle and places like that for how steep those vineyards are. But how difficult is it to pick grapes in some of your vineyards?
I used to say that when you look at the vines in Côte Rôti, yes, it's beautiful. When people visit Côte Rôti,
looks great. Yes, looks great to drive by it.
Yes, when they see this, they remember it for the rest of their lives.
Yeah.
We have no machines, so we have, let's say, a special recipe or a special request that we ask to people to work in these vineyards, and the name of this special tool is called Courage. It's the only way. It's we need very, very courageous people to climb these crazy slopes during the winter, of course, but it's cold, and eventually it's pretty good when it's cold, because think of the same thing during the summer. The name of the vineyard is Côte Rôtie. That is to say, literally, the roasted slope.
Yeah.
So you can imagine how warm or hot it can be during the summer. So, yes, we need very courageous people. And you can hear in my voice that I feel extremely proud of the people that are working for us in the vineyard. It's they are totally dedicated to, to make the same gestures, to do the same things people have been doing in the past 2,400 years. It's a tremendous work.
Well, I can hear it in all your answers, pride, not just in the people picking the grapes, but in your grandfather and your father and now you. It's funny because it is such a large, like, you guys make a lot of wine, yet at the same time, it is a very family orientated, like, it feels like it's run like a small winery, and yet, you produce about 8.5 million bottles a year. So it's funny, the dichotomy between the two sides.
Yes, we feel extremely okay with these figures with my dad, because, I'm happy to visit Toronto today, but I'm spending 24 hours in Ontario.
Because I know we have to end this, but explain your itinerary to people listening.
I left France yesterday.
Okay.
I'm going to spend the day today in Toronto.
Yep.
I'll be tomorrow in Dallas. Mm-hmm. I'll be after tomorrow in Houston.
Mm-hmm.
I will then fly to Boston for the Wine and Food Festival.
Yep.
And I fly back home on Friday.
And today you're doing this lunch here. Then you're doing a tasting with you're doing like a masterclass tasting. Then you're going to George Restaurant,
there's an 80 seat dinner.
Yeah,
with vintages and the LCBO for the guests. So
it's a full day.
It's a full day, but first of all, I'm so happy to share my passion with people that are coming to these events are not coming to earth themselves.
Mm-hmm.
They are coming to because they have the passion of wines. They want to discover about their own wines. They want to learn more about what we're doing in the Rhône Valley, and I've got this passion that I'm so happy to share with them.
And you can see it. You're a fantastic ambassador for not just Gougal, but for Rhône, as a whole, in terms of as a wine producing area. Philippe, thank you so much for doing this interview. I'd keep you for an hour, but we've got to go have lunch in a couple minutes. So really appreciate you being a part of this.
Thank you very much. Yeah. Thanks for your time, and very happy to share Rhone wines with you within a short time.
Fantastic.
Thank you.
Thanks, everyone, for listening. You've been listening to the Matt Talks Wine with Interesting People podcast. Remember, you can find me on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, and wherever good quality podcasts are sold.
Thanks for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Happy hunting.